People think manipulation is loud. They imagine raised voices, slammed doors, cruelty that leaves bruises you can point to. They imagine force. They imagine intent so obvious it can be resisted.
That's not how it works.
Real manipulation is quiet. It's patience. It's listening longer than anyone else ever has and remembering what they said when they didn't think it mattered. It's noticing which silences make someone uncomfortable and which ones make them lean in. It's learning the exact tone to use when you say someone's name so it feels like relief instead of sound.
I didn't ask him to protect me. I didn't ask him to lie. I didn't ask him to step forward when everything started collapsing. I never had to. By the time the moment came, he was already standing halfway out of himself, ready.
That's the trick no one talks about. You don't take things from people. You arrange the world so they offer.
I made him feel indispensable. Not loved, not desired, chosen, singular, necessary in a way that made absence feel like failure.
I positioned myself as the only place where his instincts were correct, where his doubts dissolved, where his better self seemed to exist. So, when things went wrong, when there were questions, when there was pressure, when someone had to be responsible, he volunteered before I could open my mouth.
Watching him accept blame was almost intimate.
I didn't choose him because he was weak. That's a mistake people make when they talk about men like him. Weak men break too fast. They panic. They look for exits. He wasn't like that. He was careful, thoughtful, the kind of man who took pride in being steady while other people unraveled.
What he wanted, more than anything, was to be seen as reliable in a way that felt irreplaceable. I noticed it the first week. The way his posture changed when someone asked for his opinion. The way he softened when I thanked him for something small. He carried usefulness like a private religion, and no one had ever worshipped it properly.
So I did.
I didn't rush intimacy. I didn't flirt the way people expect. I let him talk about work, about how people leaned on him, but never really listened, about how he was always the second call, never the first, always the one who cleaned up after someone else's mess. I listened without interrupting, without fixing, without reframing. That's important. People don't want solutions. They want confirmation that their experience is singular.
When he finished, I said, "I don't hear that from you. I hear someone who notices things other people miss."
That was the first brick. After that, I created space. Not distance, space. I didn't text too quickly. I didn't demand reassurance. I let him wonder whether he mattered, then answered that question gently, just before doubt hardened into self-protection. I shared things selectively. Not trauma, not vulnerability that would require reciprocity. I shared trust. Opinions I said I didn't give to just anyone. Thoughts I framed as half-formed, inviting him to complete them. Every time he did, I treated it like evidence of alignment instead of effort.
"You get me," I said, casually, like it was a fact we'd stumbled into.
The illusion of exclusivity isn't about isolation, it's about contrast. I let him see how other people misunderstood me, how I adjusted myself around them, how exhausting it was. And then I let myself relax around him, just slightly, just enough to feel like relief.
He didn't notice when he stopped questioning me. He noticed how good it felt to be right.
By the time anything went wrong, he was already carrying me. Not physically, emotionally. That's heavier.
I positioned my uncertainty as something only he could stabilize. I'd say things like, "I don't know why this keeps happening," or "maybe I'm just bad at explaining myself." Not accusations, invitations. He'd step into them instinctively, offering context, justification, narrative repair.
I never contradicted him. That's crucial. When someone defends you unprompted and you agree too quickly, it feels hollow. I let him build the scaffolding himself, then rested inside it. When the project started slipping, deadlines missed, numbers questioned, whispers starting to circulate, I didn't panic. I expressed confusion, hurt. I framed myself as blindsided by forces I couldn't fully see, while he was already tracking the angles.
He began saying "we" without realizing it.
Maybe we didn't communicate that clearly. Maybe we assumed they understood. Maybe we should have been more careful.
Each sentence was a small transfer of responsibility. Not forced, accepted.
The night before everything cracked, he stayed late with me. No touching, no dramatic confession, just quiet alignment. I remember thinking how intimate it felt to share the same exhaustion, the same enemy, the same unspoken understanding that someone was going to pay for this.
I didn't suggest it would be him.
I just said, I don't know what I'd do if this ruined everything. He didn't answer right away. He stared at the table, jaw tight, thinking.
When he finally spoke, his voice had that steadiness he was so proud of.
We'll handle it, he said.
That was the moment, the exact second he crossed from partner to shield.
The next day, when the questions came, I watched his body language shift. He leaned forward. He spoke carefully. He contextualized. When someone asked who had made the call, he paused, glanced at me, not for permission, but for confirmation that he was protecting the right thing. I didn't nod. I didn't shake my head. I stayed still.
He said his name.
Exposure doesn't arrive like justice. It arrives like silence. After he took the fall, things didn't explode. They settled. The room exhaled. Blame, once named, is a kind of sedative. People stopped asking questions. I was treated gently, sympathetically, as someone unfortunate enough to have been adjacent to failure rather than responsible for it. He tried to maintain eye contact with me after. Tried to read something there that would justify what he'd done. Gratitude. Relief. Recognition. I gave him distance.
That's where I miscalculated.
Emotional exclusivity works until it doesn't. Until the person you centered realizes the center is empty without you performing inside it. Once he was removed, once he was isolated, in consequence instead of closeness, he had time. Time to replay conversations. Time to notice how often his instincts had been affirmed only when they aligned with mine. Time to remember how rarely I'd been truly uncertain, how carefully my vulnerability had been rationed.
When he reached out, I didn't respond fast enough.
Not because I didn't want to. Because I didn't think I needed to anymore. That delay cracked something open.
He didn't accuse me.
Not at first. He asked questions. Specific ones. The kind that sound casual, but aren't. The kind that come from someone reconstructing a narrative with new eyes. By the time the truth surfaced, emails, timelines, decisions traced back through quiet influence instead of overt command. It didn't matter what I said. The story had shifted. I was no longer the misunderstood one. I was the constant. Being exposed doesn't feel like being caught. It feels like being misunderstood by people who finally see too much. They asked how I could let him take the blame. I wanted to say I didn't let him. I wanted to say he chose it. But choice is complicated when someone else builds the frame. The last time I saw him, he didn't look angry. He looked precise. Like someone who had learned something expensive.
You never asked, he said.
I didn't argue. Because the most convincing manipulations are the ones where no one ever has to. And the cruelest part is this. Even exposed, even named, even seen for what I was, I still knew exactly how it had felt to make him feel chosen. That knowledge doesn't go away.